The Taliban say the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan after 20 years is a victory for the Afghans and a lesson for the invaders. At least 7 Taliban members are killed and several others are wounded in clashes with militia fighters in Panjshir Valley north of capital Kabul. EU chief Ursula von der Leyen says 70% of adults in the bloc have been inoculated against COVID-19, but she's warning the pandemic is not over yet. This is World News from our Tehran studios. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Taliban have celebrated the U.S. Full withdrawal from Afghanistan after a last batch of troops left early on Tuesday. Now, that pullout marks the end of a 20-year war that brought Afghanistan nothing but destruction.
Celebratory gunfire across Kabul. Taliban fighters have marked what they called full independence of Afghanistan after the last U.S. troops left the country at dawn on Tuesday.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
The humiliation in Afghanistan was a legacy of 4 U.S. administrations. President George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan and toppled the then Taliban government after the 9/11 attacks. Washington had blamed the attacks on al-Qaeda terrorists based in Afghanistan. Bush's successor, Barack Obama, harshly criticized the invasion of Afghanistan. But his administration stuck almost with everything Bush's did. Obama maintained a major military presence in Afghanistan, frequently bombing the country with no regard for civilian lives. His administration boasted of key achievements in Afghanistan, including the training of a powerful national army. Then it was President Donald Trump's turn to stick to his election pledge on full withdrawal from Afghanistan. It took him almost his entire term in office to take the first step. It was a deal with the Taliban to pull all U.S. forces out by the end of April 2021. It came after long foot-dragging, and Trump pushed the ball in Joe Biden's court to actually act on his pledges. Biden finally took the plunge, pushing a chaotic full withdrawal in a matter of 2 weeks. It came after the Taliban ravaged the U.S.-touted Afghan army in a blitz 10-day campaign that left the group in almost full control of Afghanistan. The Afghan invasion was America's longest war. It killed an estimated 240,000 Afghans and nearly 2,500 U.S. troops. It also cost more than $2 trillion. But none of the objectives Bush had announced for the invasion were actually realized. Terror is yet to be eradicated in Afghanistan. That was also proved by the Daesh bombing that killed over 170 at Kabul airport last week. And at least a Western-style democracy was not established in Afghanistan either, which is obviously witnessed by the Taliban return to power after their government was toppled by the U.S.-led invasion of 2001. Biden only managed to put an end to the war by a hasty and humiliating exit, which some believe diminished the U.S. status as a superpower.
A political analyst, Wilmer Leon, says the departure of American forces from Afghanistan does not mean Washington would stop its interventionist policy there.
The 31st of August is significant for the people of Afghanistan. It is significant for people in Pakistan and other countries in the region. It is incredibly significant for the United States because it does bring an end to this 20-year fiasco. Unfortunately for the people of the United States, it doesn't seem to be to bring an end to the desire to continue to pump billions of dollars into the United States military, as is being reported now that Republicans are trying to add another $25 billion to the already $753 billion National Defense Authorization Act. So the money laundering scheme that I call the 20-year fiasco in Afghanistan, because the only people that really benefited from this were U.S. arms manufacturers, such as Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the others, they're going to continue, or at least the Republicans are continuing, trying their best to pump more money into them. But it does finally bring an end to this fiasco. And the other unfortunate thing, I don't think it does, it doesn't bring an end to the interventionist, imperialist American foreign policy. The mindset here, unfortunately, is still the same. The decision makers, the policy makers, have not really seemed to learn anything from this, but it does bring an end to this fiasco.
A political analyst, John Stepling, says that the U.S. justification for invading Afghanistan is an utter lie.
You have to put all of this into a 20-year perspective, right? The original justification for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was a lie from the beginning, and everybody knows that. Then there was a great deal of rhetoric about women's rights and freedom for the Afghan people and so forth and so on. The United States spent hundreds of trillions of dollars in Afghanistan. They are leaving behind massive amounts of military equipment that the Taliban will probably be able to use, repair, refurbish, and use. They left a lot of it right at the airport, in fact. But all this rhetoric from the U.S., remember, too, that military contractors outnumbered military personnel from 2017 on. And, in fact, more, private military contractors died in Afghanistan than did U.S. military personnel. Of course, more Afghans died than anyone else. And just the other day, Biden had a drone attack that wiped out an entire family. Nobody seems to care anything about this when they are indulging this rhetoric about human rights and women's rights and so forth.
Okay, now let's go to London. Our correspondent, Ahmed Caballo, is there. Ahmed, let us know where you are exactly and what's going on there.
Okay, so we're outside of the Houses of Parliament, and today is obviously a significant day because it marks the end, the deadline agreed between the US and the Taliban for foreign occupation troops to leave Afghanistan. Now, despite trillions of dollars used to prop up the Afghan government since 2001, it has been an epic failure for the occupation forces. That is because the government that they propped up was consistently ranked as one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. Successive governments, the army, the government, lacked legitimacy, and this was signaled by the fact that the former Afghan president left the country when the Taliban took over Kabul with $170 million in his airplane on his flight to United Arab Emirates. Back over to you in Tehran.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ahmed Caballo, our correspondent live for us in London. Now, at least seven Taliban members have been killed and several more wounded in clashes with militia fighters in Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley north of the capital, Kabul. Spokesman for National Resistance Forces, an anti-Taliban opposition group, said that the fighting occurred on the western entrance to the valley following a Taliban attack. He said that the raid may have been a probe to test the valley's defenses, but NRF fighters repulsed the Taliban assault. Ahmed Massoud, the son of the late anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmad Shah Massoud, has established himself in the Panjshir Valley. He leads a force of several thousand made of militia and remnants of the army and special forces. Panjshir has been the only province to hold out against the Taliban following their takeover of Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia says that eight people have been wounded in an attempted drone attack in the Abha International Airport. A civilian aircraft was also damaged in the incident in the south, Riyadh saying that the unmanned aerial vehicle was intercepted and shot down. The attack followed an earlier reported drone strike. No group has claimed responsibility yet. Different Saudi positions, including Abha Airport, have come under similar attacks in the past by the army in neighboring Yemen. Well, the Yemenis say that the strikes are retaliation for the Saudis' years-long war on their country. Now, over the past few days, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been staging protests near the so-called buffer zone to voice their anger at Tel Aviv's siege of the territory. The Israeli army has responded with live ammunition and tear gas, injuring dozens of them. But the Palestinians insist that they are determined to go on with their protests until the siege is lifted.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these, violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law and no law is going to, stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nation's assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege.
Now, Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May destroyed more than 1,800 housing units, damaging nearly 17,000 others. Now, months after the war, no significant breakthrough has been reached to reconstruct Gaza. And that's due to the tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. The siege has crippled the Strip's economy and drastically deteriorated living conditions there.
The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the Strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance, and that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest-level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem, in different areas, they're still, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
president of the European Commission says the bloc has vaccinated 70% of its adult population, but she's warning that a pandemic is not over yet.
Today, we reached an important milestone in our vaccination campaign. 70% of adults in the European Union are now fully vaccinated. And that is more than 250 million people who are immunized. And this is a great achievement, which really shows what we can do when we work together. But the pandemic is not over, and we must remain vigilant. So first of all, we need many more Europeans.
Now, Ursula von der Leyen also urged everyone to get their jabs, stressing that many more Europeans need to be vaccinated rapidly to avoid a new wave of infections and stop the emergence of new strains. The EU has secured over 620 million doses developed by American pharmaceutical company Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech. The 27-member bloc has recorded more than 36 million COVID cases and over 750,000 related deaths. And that's a wrap for this news broadcast from Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Rajiv Sial, Jason Burke and Patrick Winter. The piece is titled Taliban Assure World Leaders They Will Let Eligible People Leave Afghanistan. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul. On Sunday, 29th of August, U.S. military forces launched a strike against a vehicle which the Americans claimed was full of ISIS terrorists who were allegedly planning to attack Kabul airport. According to reports, there were multiple fatalities, including a number of Afghan children. The U.S. military has confirmed it is assessing the possibility of having killed or injured civilians in the airstrike. A significant number of British citizens told The Guardian they continue to wait at Kabul airport in the hope of being rescued despite the terror threats and the departure of all UK troops at the weekend. They sent video footage of several people clasping UK passports and pleading for help. Desperate Afghans have been told to cross the border into neighboring countries to escape the Taliban takeover. On Monday, 30th of August, The United Nations Security Council is expected to discuss the Taliban's reassurances, revealed in a statement on Sunday evening after deepening concerns over the plight of thousands of Afghans with Western links who are at their mercy. France and Britain were expected to table an emergency United Nations Security Council resolution calling for any new Afghan government to back a safe zone at Kabul Airport to allow evacuation efforts to continue, French President Emmanuel Macron said, though a Whitehall source claimed Emmanuel Macron's comments were premature. In a joint statement released on Sunday by the British government along with the United States and more than 90 other countries, it was confirmed that the Taliban had said anyone who wished to leave the country could do so, though the Taliban's pledges would be greeted with skepticism. The joint statement said, "We have received assurances from the Taliban that all foreign nationals and any Afghan citizen with travel authorization from our countries will be allowed to proceed in a safe and orderly manner to points of departure and travel outside the country." Last week, the Taliban caused shockwaves by moving to prevent Afghan citizens from leaving the country, declaring the route to Kabul Airport open only to foreign nationals. Western military forces have been trying to evacuate Afghans who have supported foreign operations as they fear they and their families could be in harm's way for working with Western powers during the 20-year war. The Taliban's latest assurances are part of delicate negotiations as the new government seeks to work with foreign governments. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Sunday that if the Taliban want diplomatic recognition and aid funding, they would have to ensure safe passage for those who want to leave the country. Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, is expected to use a US-chaired meeting with ministers from Qatar, Turkey, fellow G7 partners and NATO on Monday to stress the importance of ensuring the Taliban stand by their commitment to allow safe passage for foreign nationals and Afghan citizens authorized to enter third countries. In a further development, Britain is being urged to spearhead an international plea to fund refugee camps in countries bordering Afghanistan. John Healey, the Shadow Defense Secretary, said ministers had failed to involve critical partners in the region to avoid the current crisis, despite knowing for months that the withdrawal of U.S. forces would happen this year. Britain must lead international efforts to get neighboring countries to set up safe haven camps, he said. There has to be hard cash on the table to fund safe haven camps and the countries willing to take them. It comes after 15,000 people were evacuated from Afghanistan by British troops over the course of nearly 2 weeks under Operation Pitting, believed to be the largest evacuation mission since the Second World War. Whitehall sources believe that up to 9,000 other people with links to the British government could be left behind, however. Those remaining will be expected to reach a third country, such as Pakistan, Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan, in order to be resettled in Britain. The British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sir Laurie Bristow, who had remained in the country and relocated the embassy to Kabul Airport to process as many evacuees as possible, has now arrived back in the United Kingdom on Sunday, 29th of August, landing at RAF Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire. The final flight prompted criticism from senior military figures over the role of the British government, which was accused of failing to act on pleas to ensure the safety of Afghans who had helped soldiers. General Lord Dannatt, the former head of the British Army, told Times Radio, back in July, 45 senior officers wrote to the government saying they are people we are concerned about, and if we don't do the right thing, their blood will be on our hands. It is unfathomable why it would appear that the government was asleep on watch. Vice Admiral Ben Key, the chief of joint operations who commanded Operation Pitting, admitted there was a sense of sadness that not all could be saved. Speaking at RAF Brides Norton on Sunday morning, 29th of August, he said, "I pay testament to everything that has been achieved by coalition forces. In the end, we know there are some really sad stories of people who have desperately tried to leave, that no matter how hard our efforts, we have been unsuccessful in evacuating." Meanwhile, Colonel Richard Kemp, the former commander of British soldiers in Afghanistan, told Times Radio that Britain now faced a great danger from terrorism. Witnesses on Sunday reported an explosion near Kabul airport, and television footage showed black smoke rising into the sky. Taliban officials confirmed the U.S. account. The strike came 3 days after a suicide attack at Kabul airport that killed more than 180 people, including at least 3 British nationals and 13 U.S. service members. The Taliban condemned the strike, saying it had violated Afghanistan's sovereignty. Zabihullah Mujahid, a spokesman for the Taliban, said civilians had suffered casualties in the U.S. strike on Sunday, and a house had been hit. The Taliban and the U.S. military have increased security around Kabul airport since last Thursday's attack. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said on Saturday, 28th of August, that Washington believed there were still specific and credible threats against Kabul airport. "We would expect future attempts," he said. "We are monitoring these threats very, very specifically, virtually in real time."
We try to get close to whom Imam al-Hussein actually is.
Verily, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there is a warmth in the hearts of the believers that will never cool off.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sees that the evil system is starting to institutionalize itself.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein. Ya Habibi, Ya Tabibi, Sayyidi Mawla Hussein.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
One of the ways to remember Ashura that will help us be in the line of Imam al-Hussein, on the path of Ashura, on the path of Karbala, is to remember Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is the greatest example of someone other than the 14 Ma'sumin, following the 14 Ma'sumin. Remembering Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas and what he did and making that connection with him Remembering him in that way will increase the connection that we have with Imam al-Hussein, with Karbala. It will help us remain on or join the path of Ashura and Karbala. From my reading of the narrations regarding Karbala, Abul Fadl al-Abbas is not seen before Karbala. Abul Fadl al-Abbas, I haven't seen any quotes in Medina, I have not seen any quotes in Mecca, I have not seen any quotes on the path to Kufa, I haven't seen any quotes or anything until there's Karbala. Let's analyze this. What does this mean to us? What does this tell us? What can we gather from this? What I gather from it, again, it's not only the silence there. There's something else too. I'll add, just tell you where we get this analysis of what that small line we read of the ziyarah of Abul Fadl al-Abbas. As-salamu alayka ayyuhal abdu salih al-muti'i lillah wa li rasulih wa li amir al-mu'minin. Abul Fadl al-Abbas tried to be like towards Imam al-Husayn like his father was towards the Prophet. Amir al-Mu'minin was towards the Prophet. There's a story that I think I've mentioned more than once. I don't know if you've heard it from other speakers or from myself before, but it's something to remember. Amir al-Mu'minin was seen evidently as someone that was always in line with the Prophet, around the Prophet when he had to be, when the Prophet said, no, you're going to stay here, I'm going to go. In line with the Prophet. But this story is very interesting, where it says that one time the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi told his companions that in after Fajr prayer or fourth Fajr prayer or sometime in the morning, that they're going to meet at a certain location. Salman, which is other than the 14 Ma'sumin, at the time of the Prophet, of course, the closest to the Ma'sumin, to the extent that the hadith says, Salman minna Ahlul Bayt. Salman, while he loves Ali ibn Abi Talib, the center of attention, even for Ali ibn Abi Talib, is the Prophet. So Salman sees Amir al-Mu'mineen is always closer to the Prophet. And because of that love of the Prophet, obviously he wants to, in an effort in vain, try to compete with Ali ibn Abi Talib in a sense. Not in a bad way. Some tried to do that in a bad way. He always saw Amir al-Mu'mineen and he tried to push himself further to get close to the Prophet the way Amir al-Mu'mineen was. So this time he goes, and while he's leaving Medina or his house or wherever the direction was, he sees one set of footsteps, and so he thinks, I got my chance. Once I was able to beat Ali ibn Abi Talib in getting to the Prophet. Then he arrived where the Prophet was, he sees Ali ibn Abi Talib is there. And he's confused. Like, there's only one set of footprints. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I follow the footprints of the Prophet. I put my feet where the Prophet puts his feet. Okay, that's how much I try to follow. This is basira. This is not blind. Some people call this blind following. Whoever calls this blind following has no idea what they're talking about. I think that would be a prime example of stupidity to call this blind following. This is not blind following. This is following based on a type of insight that Musa didn't have towards Khidr, as he is referred to in the story in the Quran. God told him, learn from him. Whatever he does, whatever he says. He goes to him and said, I'm not going to disobey you. He said, well, you're not going to be patient. First incident happened. He damaged a ship or boat they went onto. Musa disobeys. He says, the insight should have been, God said this person knows. Abul Fadl al-Abbas is like, it's like he's not there. He doesn't want to be seen. He doesn't want to say anything. The word is the word of Hussein. What he says, it's only when it's a taklif of his to come out based on what Imam al-Hussein said to do something. Like in the story you've heard when the Mal'un Shimr came, apparently he was from the tribe or close to the tribe of their mother, that great lady Ummul Banin Salamullahi Alayha. One of the women of history, of the history of Islam, that is not remembered as she should be, one of the great women of the history of Islam. Some form of, but he said, he called upon Abbas to go, Abul Fadl Abbas. The account says he didn't even respond until Imam al-Hussein said, go. He said, okay. You see this as blind following? That's because if anybody does that, that's because they are blind. This is not blind following. This is insightful following. This is seeing Hussein in a way where if he says it's the time, it's the time. This takes great insight, brothers and sisters. It's important to see the conditions. And Abbas did. Abu al-Fadl Abbas did. The very fact that he's silent, didn't even object or question, and went along to the end, never mentioning any point or even asking a question regarding this, tells you that he had full confidence in this. This tells us partially he had that insight. But the channel in getting that type of insight, brothers and sisters, is not to try to find that insight independent of the ma'soom, independent of the imam. Try to say, I see something for myself. Try to look for myself. The imam has spoken, like, okay, I want to see for myself. Leave that aside. Let me see. That's not the way you gain insight. Al-muti' lillah wa li rasulih wa li amir al-mu'minin. You gain insight by listening to Allah where you don't see. When you listen to Allah where you don't see, He will show you. When you listen to Wajhullah, the Imams, when you don't see, He will show you, give you that insight to the specifics of the condition. Then you start seeing, yes, besides trusting Hussein, I see the conditions and it is exactly as he says. I see crystal clear. A person who doesn't obey the ma'soom in this way will never be able to see in that way. Never. Ya Hussein, Ya Habib. Ya Hussein, Ya Habib. Ya Hussein, Ya Habib. Ya Hussein, Ya Habib.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading UN Report Calls for Reparations for Victims of Systematic Racist Police Violence in the U.S. Stay tuned for more. On June 28, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, released a stunning 23-page report accompanied by a 95-page conference room paper for the UN Human Rights Council, HRC, documenting systematic racism and human rights violations by police forces against Africans and people of African descent throughout the world. The report considered more than 340 interviews and more than 100 submissions from civil society organizations. Bachelet grounded her analysis in the long overdue need to confront the legacies of enslavement, the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and to seek reparatory justice. She took aim at misconceptions that the abolition of slavery, the end of the transatlantic trade in enslaved Africans and colonialism, and subsequent reforms have eliminated the racially discriminatory structures built by those practices and created equal societies. The report finds the dehumanization of people of African descent, a practice rooted in false social constructions of race created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and widely accepted harmful practices and traditions, has sustained and cultivated a tolerance for racial discrimination, inequality, and violence, which continues to have a disproportionate impact on the enjoyment of their human rights. Systematic racism needs a systematic response, Bachelet wrote. States should adopt a systematic approach to combating racial discrimination through the adoption and monitoring of whole-of-government and whole-of-society responses. They should be designed to dismantle systematic racism. Hailing the report as a victory, the U.S. Human Rights Network, USHRN, issued a statement saying it reflects the efforts of civil society to educate UN officials about human rights violations and the people's solutions, even convening a People's Commission of Inquiry to take on what the UN declined to do last year. After the killing of George Floyd and subsequent mass protests, the USHRN and the ACLU organized an international coalition that urged the HRC to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate systematic racism and police violence against people of African descent in the United States of America. Instead, on June 19, 2020, after intensive lobbying by Trump administration, the HRC adopted Resolution 43-1, directing the High Commissioner to prepare a report on police violence and other human rights violations against Africans and people of African descent around the world, not limited to the United States. Thus, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, National Conference of Black Lawyers, and National Lawyers Guild established their own international commission inquiry on systematic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. The commission issued its report on April 15, 2021. The worldwide mobilization of people calling for racial justice has forced a long-delayed reckoning with racism and shifted debates towards a focus on the systematic nature of racism and the institutions that perpetrate it, Bachelet wrote. Bachelet's report indicts the culture of systematic racism, denial and impunity of law enforcement officials for violating the human rights of people of African descent. She lays blame for the racialization of poverty at the feet of insufficient, meaningful participation of people of African descent in decision-making and impediments to their right to vote. Bachelet charges that the dehumanization of people of African descent is rooted in false social constructions of race historically created to justify enslavement, pervasive racial stereotypes, and false narratives that associate people of African descent with criminal activities. Discriminatory identity checks and stops and searches are attributable to racial profiling, according to Bachelet. And she condemns disproportionate stops, arrests, and imprisonment for drug-related offenses. Bachelet's analysis of 190 cases globally, most from the United States, revealed that at least 85% of police-related deaths could be attributed to policing of minor offenses, traffic stops and searches, such as the case of George Floyd, intervention of police as first responders to mental health crises, and special police operations like the case of Breonna Taylor. Many of the victims did not pose an imminent threat of death or serious injury to justify lethal force under international legal standards. Harmful stereotypes shape encounters between people of African descent and law enforcement, and gang-related police operations in communities of African descent are frequently influenced by racial bias and stereotypes that associate those communities by criminality, Bachelet found, citing the commission report. Challenges to holding police officers accountable for violating human rights of people of African descent, detailed by Bachelet, include the absence of independent accountability mechanisms and deficient investigations, prosecutorial direction and reluctance to file charges against police, qualified immunity and police unions, citing the Commission's report discussion of these issues. As did the commission report, Bachelet cited a 2021 University of Chicago study which found that use of force legislation and directives in the largest cities of the 29 wealthiest countries often did not comply with international human rights law. No state has comprehensively accounted for the past or for the current impact of systematic racism, Bachelet notes, adding, structures and systems that were designed and shaped by enslavement, colonialism, and successive racially discriminatory policies and systems must be transformed. Jamil Dakwar, director of the ACLU's Human Rights Program, also responded to Bachelet's report, stating, "This historic report provides a blueprint for the United States and other countries to begin reckoning with the long history of systematic racism that permeates through policing and other state violence and structural discrimination against black people. We welcome this report and urge the Biden administration and Congress to heed the recommendations and take bold action to eliminate systematic racism in the United States, starting with policing institutions. Bachelet writes, reparatory justice requires a multi-pronged approach that is grounded in international rights law. Reparations are one element of accountability and redress. For every violation, there should be repair of the harms caused through adequate, effective, and prompt reparation. She notes that reparations are not limited to monetary compensation, but also include formal apologies, memorializations, institutional and educational reforms, and acknowledgement of the legal responsibility of the state for violations linked to truth, justice, guarantees of non-recurrence. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What is the use of crying and mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein after 1400 years? Why are you disseminating sadness, crying and tears among people? They complain. This is not sadness and tears for the sake of sadness and tears. This is for the sake of the values, the things that lie behind the lamentation, beating the chest and the head, and shedding tears are the dearest things that one might find in the treasure trove of humanity. And they are the divine spiritual values. The Shia are trying to uphold the fact that Hussein ibn Ali is the epitome of all these values. The Shia are trying to keep their memories alive. And if the Muslim Ummah keeps Imam Hussein's name and memory alive and follows him, it will overcome all the obstacles and the hardships. And that is why all of us in the Islamic Revolution, in the Islamic Republic, from the highest to the lowest echelons, including the people, the authorities, the senior officials, and our Honorable Imam have relied on the issue of Imam Hussein and the issue of Ashura and people's mourning. The mourning has a symbolic as well as a realistic aspect. It binds hearts together and it broadens knowledge.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
I would like to discuss a point regarding the efforts to promote Islam in the month of Muharram. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This is why Imam Khomeini recommended the traditional forms of mourning. The Quranic verses about the role of the infallible Imams are interpreted in three different ways. Vilayat is one of these interpretations. Your guardian can only be Allah and His Messenger and those who believe, who establish worship and pay charity and bow down in prayer. The Holy Quran, chapter 5, verse number 55. Another interpretation is submission and obedience. Obey Allah and obey the Messenger and those in authority from among you. The Holy Quran, chapter 4, verse number
Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.